Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome back to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that talks about movies, gets a little in-depth, and gets a little mentally messy. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and I'm here alongside with my co-host,
Chad Riley. Couldn't be more excited to be here.
We are so excited to be here. You know, we just had a great day, and we had an awesome talk a little bit ago about what we're going to be talking about today, and, you know, we got pretty amped up.
But you know, we like to wait until the last minute to prep.
Exactly. You know, we're the type of people that are on the cuff. We are ready to do it at a moment's notice. We are here for you. Yes, that is right. Filmlosophers are here for you. You heard it first from us, the Filmlosophers.
Yeah, that's us, and we're here.
The show is brought to you and presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded here at beautiful VGB Studios.
So pretty.
We really love the fact that we have this opportunity to record here because we get a chance to, as everybody has heard in the last episode, we have a chance to be in the presence of Mr. Corey Vinson, who, although you can't see him or hear him, which you probably couldn't see altogether because it's a podcast, he's here.
Always here.
He's our fly on our wall.
I didn't even know that. And I come here to work.
Yeah, you know what? Filmlosophers, though, you can check us out and hear all our episodes. Now we're on Audio Boom, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and also on iTunes. So check it out. Click and subscribe. Listen to previous episodes.
Let us know what you think.
Exactly. And you know what? Let us know exactly what you think by, you know, leaving a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/filmlosophers or twitter.com/filmlosophy101. You know, leave us a comment. Leave us a suggestion, complaint. Yeah, however you want to put it. Whatever
likes,
you think of the
loves,
show.
Likes, loves, wows, ha-has. Sad if you need to. I prefer no angries, but, you know.
Hey, you know,
it happens.
I'll take what I can get. Any kind of feedback from you guys is great feedback because whatever makes our show better is all the better for us.
And for you. I mean, the more we know that we can, you know, get better at, the better your experience will be too.
So with that, we're going to go ahead and get into today's show. We got an exciting episode geared up for you guys. So you know what? Let's go ahead and saddle up and ride them out.
Classes in session.
So right off the top of that, we're going to go and hit movie news. Today, Disney has released a new Alice Through the Looking Glass trailer, along with new images. The sequel is returning to Underland with a new story that finds Mia Wasikowska.
Wasikowski?
Johnny Depp, Anne Hathaway, and Helena Bonham Carter all returning to their original roles alongside new cast members, Sacha Baron Cohen and Rhys Ifans. That's one of those ones that you pretty much would want to go to the internet to learn how to pronounce. But the plot finds Alice out to save her friend the Mad Hatter from the nefarious Time Lord, or Time, which is Sacha Baron Cohen's.
You were on the line,
you
right
know,
there.
You know,
on
it's
the line.
It's one of those things where, you know, you never really, I mean, if you've looked at this trailer for the sake of all that is good in this world, if you've seen this trailer, you would feel just about as confused as I am, because this trailer has so much in it that I'm not even really certain what it's about.
Can I just, and I know we're going to end up talking about this because everybody's going to end up talking about this for a while, but one of the takeaways that a lot of people have had about Batman v Superman, which came out last week, is that it had a lot going on. This Alice Through the Looking Glass trailer has almost as much as that whole movie going on in about 2 minutes' time.
Exactly.
It is, like, ballistic.
There are things in the trailer that are just all over the place as far as things that you remember from the first one, things that you thought were resolved in the first one, and then you're seeing it back in this one, then you don't really know what Sacha Baron Cohen's role is. You're not sure if he's just going
to
be...
He kind of, like, freezes people when he wants to because he's controlling the time of their lives. And
and honestly, because of his previous roles, I only see him as Borat, and he kind of looks like a blue-eyed Borat in this one, so I'm not looking forward to it
too really,
much.
With a really, really, really tall hat.
Yeah, but speaking of really tall... Fox is turning April 26th into Alien Day. The day will encompass a wide range of activities, including a nationwide double feature screening of Alien and Aliens with
back to back
with a special 24-hour long trivia challenge on Twitter via @AlienAnthology with prizes every 42.6 minutes. and the release of Reebok's Alien Stomper sneakers, an exact replica of the high-top stompers worn by Sigourney Weaver's character, Ellen Ripley. So, you know, this is something that you and I have had a lot of chance to talk about as far as Ridley Scott's role in just creating an awesome franchise in this. And so being able to actually commit a day to celebrate it, I'm all for it.
Yeah, and it's really interesting if you read the press release, which I'm in marketing, so I like to do things like that. lots of people don't. Hey. But, it's one of those they're really celebrating the release of the first movie, but it wasn't quite 30 years ago. It was a little more than 30 years, so then they had to also kind of connect it with the second movie, and everybody wins, basically, is the point of yeah. all of that.
Yeah, and if you're a fan of the more recent ones as opposed to the older ones, I mean, whoever you are, wherever you are, whatever you're a fan of, you can't negate the fact of how much these films made an impact in what is now sci-fi thriller cinema.
Oh, truly iconic is the word to use.
Because, I mean, you have heroines like Ellen Ripley, who is played by the incredible Sigourney Weaver. And, she created such a heroine in that one that there's been just straight emulation in just every other role that has
come out. Sure, well, in any other strong female action hero role, at some point, people like us who are commenting on the movie refer back to Ellen Ripley.
Ellen Ripley.
I mean, she was really a standard bearer for this kind of a role. And, I mean, it doesn't hurt to have an amusement park ride kind of patterned after your movie either.
There's an amusement park ride, Doctor?
Oh, heck yeah. Used to be at Universal Studios in Florida way back when. I don't know about California. I'm not from around here originally.
Yeah, I'm not from around here either, so I'm not too sure. But
anyway, if you want to register for the 24-hour Twitter competition, you do have to pre-register your Twitter handle. Go to alienanthology.com.
With hashtag AlienDay426. And speaking of which, also as far as franchises and long-running things, Ralph Fiennes' Alfred is featured in the latest teaser for the Lego Batman movie. So fresh off the heels of last week's debut trailer, Warner Brothers has released a second teaser trailer for the Lego Batman movie with a direct reference to the Batman franchise overall, mentioning pretty much every Batman debut year. The teaser also features Ralph Fiennes as his portrayal of Alfred as he is trying to get Bruce Wayne to talk about how he's feeling while Bruce is doing everything he can comically.
So this second trailer is awesome. It starts out with Lego Batman all dressed down in his robe, but he still has the cowl on his head and whatnot, talking to an image of his parents, who have passed away, spoiler alert, and he's talking, and Alfred comes in and says, are you talking to your parents again? And then proceeds to kind of outline how many times we've either seen what happened in his childhood mm-hmm. or heard the character talk about it, which is every single cinematic appearance of the character of Batman. It's really well done. It's really fun, just like all the other Lego stuff.
And what's great about this trailer, this teaser, is the fact that they immediately make mention of 2016. So they immediately make mention of the current Batman versus Superman film that's now in theaters. And as they continue to go down, Alfred even states, even the weird time, back in 1970 or 1960 where they show Adam West doing like the eye thing, from Pulp Fiction.
Because they do kind of intermingle actual live action footage with mm-hmm. the Lego, they kind of show you what they're referencing.
What do you think as far as how the franchise is going with Lego movies moving into demographics such as like Batman, Superman, Lord of the Rings? There's been a big shift in Lego moving on. And how do you think Lego is going to do as far as continuing doing things like Batman or doing things like Back to the Future, stretching out of their norm?
I think that they're I think it's a successful model to follow. I think that they kind of really, in terms of the Lego games, they really latched onto something there with connecting to popular movie franchises, and this is just an extension of that. I thought Batman was a standout character in the Lego movie, and I think that these movies are probably going to work for a while too.
And speaking of the franchise, on today's show, we're going to go ahead and talk about a movie that, not many people really enjoy all that much, but me and Chad have found a hero among this film. We have actually revisited and found a newfound love for it. That's right, gentlemen. We are talking, and ladies, we're talking about the infamous, if you haven't guessed
this
it yet.
This music is such a tease, too.
It really is.
This is not the movie that we're talking about. what?
So if you're going, if you're jumping up and down and getting excited because you're thinking, oh, they're going to visit Superman 1, Christopher Reeve. That's the guy who does.
Yeah, we're not touching. We're not touching.
We are not going near that. No, ladies and gentlemen, what we are touching today is Zack Snyder's Man of Steel.
Man of Steel.
Now, of course, there's a huge backlash of the film. There's a lot of people who go about and state that it was this, it was that, it was garbage, it was boo-boo, it was whatever you want to call it, however you want to call it, whatever language would you use, whatever type of language you use. But you know what? In light of recent events, in light of the new film that just recently came out last week, which we did a review on in the last episode, Man of Steel has actually come out to become more of a mainstay in the current DC universe that we have.
Sure. I mean, they kicked off kind of the new vibe. So you had the conclusion of Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy. You had the question mark of, is that going to lead into more of these characters? Is it going to be a direct spinoff of the Nolan films, which Nolan does still serve as one of the main producers, executive producers of Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. But Man of Steel kind of is a new beginning altogether. It's the first in a new integrated series of movie franchises representing DC Comics characters that people have grown to love over the years. And when it first came out, it was, you know, kind of not all that well received. I enjoyed it. I thought that it was great. Helped in no small part by the musical soundtrack, which was just killer. It really, really helped maintain the momentum of the story. But there were a lot of people who weren't all that fond of it.
Yeah. And just to kind of clarify things and let everybody know, we are talking about 2013's Man of Steel. Zack Snyder directed, Henry Cavill led that masterpiece that we were talking about. So just to give you guys
it's a masterpiece now, huh?
Well, you know, in terms of what we're referencing it to now and what we have to compare it to within the current DC cinematic universe, I would say it's pretty up there. It's got a pretty Michelangelo vibe going for me right now, as opposed to what we got, you know, second grade drawings out of, you know, this current Dawn of Justice.
Oh, come on. It was also beautiful. It was messy, beautiful, but it had a lot of really gorgeous moments in it. But yeah, we had the benefit of going back, rewatching Man of Steel after seeing Dawn of Justice, just to kind of get a feel for where are those on-ramps for the other characters. Mm-hmm. Is the Superman character consistent from one movie to the next? And yeah, we came away with, in some respects, a newfound appreciation for Man of Steel, which is not all that old, but is already starting to age well, let's say.
Yeah. And just to give you guys a heads up, as far as on the synopsis for this film, if you haven't seen Man of Steel, which I'm pretty
Shame
sure
on
most
you.
People have, but if you haven't, I'd like to invite you to come out from under your rock and, you know, just
come into the light.
Experience the world, you know. But the synopsis from Warner Brothers themselves says, a young boy learns that he has extraordinary powers and is not of this earth. As a young man, he journeys to discover where he came from and what he was sent here to do. But the hero in him must emerge if he is to save the world from annihilation and become the symbol of hope for all mankind. So that sounds like, you know, a fair weight on anybody's shoulders. But as far as the film is concerned, Chad does make a very clear point as far as the soundtrack. But before we get into the soundtrack, let's just kind of go over as far as what key points of the film really were just highlights of it, which we could be here a long time if we went through every single one of them. But so
we're going to have to keep it quick.
We're going to have to keep it
tidy.
Quick. But right off the bat, one of the biggest positives for me was introducing Krypton more as a planet and the people around it and actual life on Krypton. It seemed more integrated to the story as being part of it rather than just this individual is from this planet. It exploded because of this, and now he's on Earth. What Zack Snyder did was take the direction of, well, you know what would be really great if we actually invested some time into knowing where Zor-El and Lara-El...
Jor-El,
I'm sorry.
You mean the father of...
Yes, what did
Kal-El?
I say?
You said Zor-El.
Zor-El.
That's probably some other bit character in mythology, but Jor-El is his father.
Jor-El and Lara-El, how they come about actually having Kal and what it means, what he actually means as being a an actual birth, not as opposed to what the society was used to when they would actually create.
Yeah, they kind of had this whole planned approach to new births. Every child's genetic code was already coded and decided upon. They had a role in the society, yada yada yada. And these two figures decide to have the first natural birth
in centuries. And
Snyder and company really dig in deep into sort of the basic broad stroke shading of Krypton society right before the fall, which is, I thought, very compelling. And it's really intriguing that they spent a good chunk of time. It's not a 5-minute sequence. It goes on for, what, 15, 20 minutes. Yeah.
And going back to what you said as far as that soundtrack, even in that opening scene, the opening scene, you know, comes about when Cal's being birthed, and you have that swell of that type of noiristic style music coming into the fray, and you're hearing that whoom, and as it builds, you get a sense of what you're looking forward to with the rest of this film as it builds through and as the film continues. The music becomes as much a part of the scene, because you have certain movies that they'll throw in songs here and there, and it's just for, you know, aesthetics. It's just for however. You know, they'll throw this in there because, oh, so-and-so is in the urban area, so we're going to throw in a rap song. Or this person's out in the middle of a country area, so we'll throw in a country song. Or we'll throw this style of music. We'll throw that. The music at first, right off the bat, doesn't really sound like it goes with the ultimate film idea overall.
Well, here's the thing about Zack Snyder, and many people have said that about Dawn of Justice, and it's something that several people noticed even in Man of Steel. He kind of approaches it the way you would an opera or a Broadway show, where each character has a certain sound within the soundtrack, and each of the main beats of the story has a certain sound to it as well. And the job that any opera or Broadway show has at the very beginning, before you even know the story that's being told, is to kind of start painting that picture of sound. And they give you a taste of the happy, the sad, the ethereal, the action-oriented. And one of the things that this film did really well, Man of Steel, is it gave you a really great primer for all the different types of beats that were going to happen for the rest of the movie in the first 15 minutes or so. And it gives you all the musical programming that your brain is going to need to know, you know, this is a sad moment, this is a happy moment, this is a, you know, fighting moment, and this is a relenting, you know, kind of thing. They did a really nice job. It's very poetic and very operatic in the beginning.
And speaking of those opening scenes, we also get our first glimpse, obviously, like I said, of Jor-El and Lar-El. But you also get your first glimpse of your end villain, which is Zod, General Zod, and his coup. You know, and you get to see him. And I'll be the first to admit it. When I heard that Michael Shannon was going to be taking that role, I wasn't really a big Michael Shannon fan.
I had no idea who he was.
I had seen him in a couple of things. He was in movies like he was in 8 Mile. He was the guy who was dating Eminem's mom, and he was in a movie called
For Real?
Yeah.
Oh.
He was in a movie called Bug with one of the Judd sisters, the one that Ashley Judd, I believe, the one who acts.
That one.
And he was in a few other ones, but
yeah, he was new to me in this film. But I mean,
yeah,
talk about really going for it. I mean, he was General Zod.
Yeah, he really, you could tell he really came out to it, to really embody the character. He really wanted to fully commit to the mindset of who this character was, as opposed to, you know, what we could have gotten in any other iteration of the film itself. I think having General Zod be the first villain and having Michael Shannon play him, I was so glad that I was wrong, because he really did an excellent job. Now, when I heard that was going to be the first villain, I had my own ideas of who I thought could have been a good Zod. But
well, sure. I mean, back in the older franchise that we're not talking about, it was, what, Terrence Stamp?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Did General Zod. And, you know, I mean, Shakespearean, classically trained theater actor. I mean, it has a much different feel than what they were going for in this film, which is more of a almost a force of nature.
Yeah. Yeah. With Michael Shannon and his role as far as the character itself. Did you have any ideas as far as who you thought maybe could have played Zod before you would have thought of Michael Shannon?
Not really. I was shocked that they weren't going to go for Lex Luthor.
Really?
Just because he is, to the mainstream people, he's the most well-known villain. Smallville had been on TV stations, for several, 10 years?
By that point.
It wasn't on the air anymore, I don't think, when this movie came out. But, Lex Luthor is a character in that show. He's a contemporary of Clark's in those ways. So I was surprised that they went full Kryptonian, to be quite honest. And they really did. They went full Kryptonian society, Kryptonian mythology. The S on his chest is not an S. It's a symbol of hope on Krypton. And so he has that whole legacy to kind of live up to as he learns who he is and what he can do and what he should do and make some decisions that trickle through not only this film but on into Dawn of Justice and presumably the whole rest of, whatever they build out with Justice League and all the rest of the films. It starts here, and it starts with a heavy dose of Krypton.
Yeah. And just one last thing as far as speaking about Krypton itself in that opening scene, the destruction of Krypton. Ultimately, from the beginning when you're first introduced to it, to the as you see Jor-El explaining to the council what's going on with Krypton, and then to the explosion of it, I thought that entire ending scene of that particular clip, I thought that was really well done and pretty much considerate for a lot of people. I mean, if you would have just left it as, sending Cal to go off to somewhere else and then just jump to his experience on Earth, having that amount of closure with that opening scene was probably like the smartest thing to do, because in thinking of time wise, if you are considering, you don't want to do a really long movie, you don't want to overbore your audience, you don't want to do these things, so you may cut things that may not be necessary or may already be implied.
Well, and you also don't want to jump too quickly to the next point in the story. The thing that they did really effectively with that opening sequence, similar to Up, similar, you and I were talking before we started recording, similar to the Star Trek reboot, they tell a complete story in that opening sequence before the main story starts. You get a lot of the pathos. You get a lot of that sense of the sacrifice that the parents make for their child. They know that their planet is doomed. They know that they're not going to get off in time. They know that everything goes with him and he's going alone out into the stars. And they make that choice, and it has a lot of gravity to it, a lot of weight. And then Snyder and company go ahead and let you linger, not only through the sentencing of Zod and his compatriots to 300 cycles of suspended animation, torture, whatever that is. But they also show you the destruction of the planet. Kal-El's mother telling the computer entity that there's no escape for them. The planet's over and they are too. And it just has that poignant touch all before you truly meet Clark and what he's become as a grown man, and even the little episodes that they sprinkle in from his childhood and his developing years. So I think that, like Up, like the Star Trek reboot film, they were trying to give you a lot of compassion for him before you ever saw him.
Yeah.
And I personally thought it paid off. Some people didn't like it. I really thought it was not only clever, but it was fitting to the story they ultimately were telling.
Yeah, and like I said, it was ultimately, I think the ultimate thought was that it was considerate to create that complete minute, although in retrospect to the whole film itself, it wasn't as big of a part, but it was still an intricate part of the entire story. Having that foundation laid, that groundwork already built, so that what already weight is on his shoulders even before he makes it to Earth.
Even before he knows.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So we move from Krypton and we move to Earth, which Clark or Cal lands and obviously, which I thought was pretty unique. They didn't actually show the landing, but they actually transitioned over to a boat crashing in the water and moving and so forth, which...
He's now grown. Yeah. He's got the beard. He's on the open sea catching fish or, crabs or whatever.
He's got crabs or something. But the idea that he they remove that whole having to go through the lengthy portion of explaining in detail step by step for the fact that Smallville had been on TV already, and the fact that everybody was already introduced to the different avenues of his life already created by the Smallville franchise. Foregoing having to create that lengthy part of his life and making it a mainstay in the film, having it to be a solid portion of the film, foregoing that and going straight to his adulthood with the flashbacks, I thought was a very intelligent idea.
Absolutely. You don't want to tell the same story that's already been told. Otherwise, you may as well not have made this movie. You should have done a movie spinoff of the TV show Smallville. Exactly. And just to make sure we're clear, the movie is not a spinoff of Smallville.
No.
Let's call them alternate universes, because, you know, they're not the same. The past that he has with Lex Luthor, for example, or Lois Lane in Smallville, he knew her when he was in, you know, college age in young adulthood, and he meets her in this film. So we're not saying that they're concurrent, that one leads to the other, but you don't want to tell a story that's primarily focused on his high school and college years, because somebody already tried that.
Exactly.
And they made it as a TV show. So now you've got a much bigger budget to make it as a movie. What are you going to do that's unique and special? Well, they went ahead and fast-forwarded straight to his, you know, 20-somethings years. And he's kind of wandering out there and finding his way both as a human being and as something else.
Yeah.
And then you see glimpses of the past, you know, from when he was young, when he was, you know, going through puberty and all that kind of stuff as the story plays out.
Yeah. You know, and moving from that point, you know, you get the first glimpse of seeing him in action as he's saving people on the oil rig, and you see, you know, him trying to make ends meet in little places here and there, and not so much. I mean, obviously he makes it a big noticeable thing when he uses his powers on the oil rig, but then he does the unique thing of trashing this really huge jerk at this bar called Cassidy's Pub, and trashes his truck like crazy, and which I thought was pretty funny.
Yeah, it's a great comeuppance.
Like, you just really ticked off this superhuman alien.
You have no idea whose toes you just stepped on.
Exactly. And so we see him finally make some headway to actually finding some type of answers and so forth. And so as the film continues, we get our introduction of Lois Lane, whom is played by Amy Adams. One of the big things that I keep hearing, and I don't agree with, because I'll give my reasons in a sec, but one of the things I keep hearing is that Amy Adams is too old to play Lois Lane, or at least the Lois Lane for Clark Kent in the current storyline. I don't believe that. I don't believe Amy Adams may be. I'm not too sure how old she is, but I think the idea of how she portrays herself, how she portrays the character, may seem more mature than what we're used to seeing.
Sure.
But I don't think, and I could be wrong, but I don't think she's that much older than...
She probably isn't. You know, I am one of those people that when I first saw the casting news, I thought, oh, so they're casting an older Lois and a younger Clark. That would be different and interesting. It wasn't something that I was upset by or that offended me in any way, but I can definitely see why people would say that. And maybe you're right. Maybe it's the way that she carries herself as a performer. Beyond just this role, because you know, some actors really disappear into their part, mm-hmm. and some just kind of, oh, you're Amy Adams, you know, like, not that she's not talented, she's phenomenally talented and she can do an amazing job on screen, but there's something about the recognition that she had before this movie was made that it's kind of hard to put off some of the other things that you know about her and how many times you've seen her in movies already versus Henry Cavill, who hasn't been in as many movies, usually was playing, you know, somebody in their early 20s, regardless of how old he actually was.
Yeah.
You know, when he filmed. So you kind of get that same sense here. Also, you know that he's British and he's, you know, faking the American accent and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, there's a little bit in his portrayal that kind of naturally is going to feel different. And, you know, I don't know. Like I said, it wasn't a turnoff for me, but I can see where people are coming from. It does seem like Lois is older than Clark.
Yeah. And I was just looking at the numbers, and she's about maybe 9 years older than he is. But on screen,
you
have
the performer,
the actual
Amy Adams and Henry Cavill are 9 years ish apart. Okay.
Yeah. There's that difference. But even in her portrayal of Lois Lane, Lois is just a more mature, go getter type, independent style woman. She's very much the epitome of what women would probably aspire to have been like in the 60s or the 50s. One of those, I'm pretty sure that's what really went into creating the character. And that really followed through with who she is in this film. And then you have somebody who's like Henry Cavill, who is set out to play the American farm boy, clean shaven somewhat, and very
eventually.
Much eventually, you know, with his superhuman Gillette razor. And, you know,
does that work?
That is a question for a whole nother show. But, you know, you have somebody who's baby faced and you have some slick back hair, clean shaven. I mean, obviously, that's going to really, really intensify and amplify the age difference. But I think the way she portrayed Lois Lane was probably spot on as far as what you would expect in a live action movie. You know, her.
Sure. Well, and really, I mean, the thing that you should actually be caring about is, did she do a good job as Lois Lane? Did he do a good job as Clark slash Kal-El slash, you know, eventually Superman? Although it's good to point out the movie is called Man of Steel because he's never called Superman.
Mm-mm.
She comes very close at one point, sort of pitching the idea to him when they're in the bunker, considering whether or not he's going to turn himself into this, you know, crazy alien guy who brought his ship into Earth orbit and took over all of the technology on the entire planet, you know, in a snap, and spoke every language like it was, you know, his native tongue, just so he could find this one individual that he was looking for. So you know, you take all of that dramatic backdrop and you say, can they pull off the roles? And I think individually they do. I'd say together their chemistry is maybe not as strong as it could be,
because
you have some expectation about Clark Kent, Lois Lane. They meet, they fall in love, he saves her maybe, or she saves him, you know, depending on how you're telling the story. And there wasn't as much depth to the connection as I probably would have liked to see in a movie that has so much to build on in terms of other movies, TV shows, cartoons, all the comics, everything. You know, you'd kind of like to see them take the relationship a little bit further in terms of the depth of it. The immediacy is there, and they both do a fine job individually in their roles. I would say that would be one of the few tweaks that I would point out as something that would have benefited the movie. But how about you? What are some things that you noticed that you didn't like?
You know, overall, I wasn't a big fan of the Lumbar character. I didn't see the need for him.
He's like a sports reporter at the Daily Planet.
He's something. I wasn't even certain. I was like, you know, in this role, you know what would have been better? A Jimmy Olsen. I would have appreciated a Jimmy Olsen in this role instead of this character whom I really have nothing invested in. If he dies, he dies. Not to sound cold, but, you know, the fact remains is that
he came out of nowhere.
Exactly. You know, I mean, I could understand the Jenny character. She's an intern, and they established that. So she's right off the bat. You're made known
that
she's expendable.
Which back in the day, everybody thought, oh, it's not Jimmy Olsen. They turned Jimmy into a girl,
Jenny.
And called her Jenny.
Yeah,
which we learn in Dawn of Justice isn't true.
Which we learn in Dawn of Justice, Jimmy is actually
is a character.
Is a character,
not Jenny. There is a Jimmy Olsen.
There is a Jimmy Olsen, and let's just
briefly say in that movie, there is a Jimmy Olsen.
He's in the beginning scene, and that's it. But that was one of my biggest critiques. Just kind of take away from right now, I didn't really appreciate his character. I'm not a very big fan of that particular actor. You know, so it's one of those things where the only exposure I've had to him was House of Cards. He played Frank Underwood's, what do you call it? Right hand guy. So. You know, and House of Cards was a good show with Kevin Spacey, you know, another guy who's
still is.
Played,
still is. On.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's on like its fifth season or something, fifth season. So my exposure to him wasn't all that great. So seeing him play this role, you know, kind of lighthearted, kind of cheesy, kind of whatever, I wasn't really a fan.
It was very different than what you're used to seeing that actor. I think his name is Michael Kelly. I could be wrong about that. But it's different than what you're used to seeing him play, for sure. And it's really one of those roles that it's one of those parts where you recognize the person's face and you know that you know them from somewhere, so you expect the part to go somewhere, and it really doesn't. He's kind of there just for comic relief. He's a bit of a foil to Lois. He's not as professional as a reporter as she is. He's a little bit of a womanizer. He's pursuing her, not with any passion or clear intent. He kind of just wants to get her to go out with him.
Yeah.
And eventually he's convinced to do something semi-heroic by his boss, Perry.
Yeah.
You know, when all the buildings are crumbling and tumbling down and intern Jenny gets trapped inside the rebar. Yeah.
So that was one of the things. The other thing that I wasn't really a big fan of was a lot of the unanswered questions that I had in regards to the ship. You know,
which ship?
The ship that
there are several.
There are several. You make a great point. The ship that Clark finds within the ice.
The one that the government is Canada trying to figure out, is this a Soviet sub or something else?
It doesn't make a lot of sense as far as with number one, when he's going through and he sees a couple pods open, or one pod that's open, you see a bunch of them that are filled with dead bodies because apparently they didn't get out. But there is one pod that's open, and it's not revealed until later in an interview with Zack Snyder that it's supposed to be Supergirl.
Which makes zero sense.
Which makes none sense.
We'll bypass that whole thought.
And then there's no explanation as far as just things like the Genesis Chamber. It doesn't really say how it's supposed to work with his DNA having the codex within him. Like, is he supposed to, like, die and give up himself so that he
can... Yeah, there's a lot of fuzzy science.
There is.
You know, anytime you have a somewhat science fiction-y property, you know, there's the whole internal consistency and internal logic of the story that you've got to have. But there's definitely, like, wait a minute, there was gold writing on some like Neanderthal looking skull that was the codex to decoding all the secret genetics that nobody else can decode without this thing, but they had to encode them somehow, and that was all somehow put into his DNA, split up between his cells, and don't cells replicate and eventually die? And I mean, there's a whole sub logic of
the science behind it. Yeah, and
super science.
But, you know, just the little things. I mean, and mind you, the negatives that I have for the film are small and petty, just for the sake of my own mindset and my own likes and dislikes. But I think overall, the film really does push a solid story forward as far as we see Cal's fruition of the role of Superman. Or they don't say it, but
he gets there eventually by the end.
And so you understand his whole journey to fully understanding why he was sent to Earth, why the Codex was put within him, what his parents' whole goal was for sending him there.
And yeah, luckily his little the key essentially that turns on all the spaceships for him that he has in a necklace around his neck as a young man. Luckily, that includes like a whole data copy of Jor-El's consciousness, so that when he plugs it into the spaceship, Jor-El comes out and tells him everything that he needs to know.
Which, mind you, I did have to say I appreciate, because if I would have seen another floating head like Marlon Brando in Superman 1 of Russell Crowe, I'm like, the man's head's big enough already. I don't think it needs a...
Costumes, I mean, come on.
That was great. Jor-El's
costume?
Yeah.
Phenomenal, especially the battle part.
Oh, yeah.
That was, you know, all the different parts and pieces clicking into place, but...
Straight on Transformer-like.
Yeah.
But as we push through the film and we get to the whole climactic part of it, as we see him battling against Zod and his group of insurgents and over the fate of the world, ultimately, I thought that the idea of having Zod become like Superman as far as his honing his senses, being able to do pretty much everything that Cal can do, I thought that was a pretty cool part. Because if you saw, like, with the first Superman, or I'm sorry, the second one with General Zod coming in, you have him already having all these crazy superpowers. He can do all these things, and there's no real progress to that as far as how he gets to that point. What kind of effect does Earth's atmosphere and everything have on Kryptonians? And that's not
really...
And vice versa.
Sort of go into a little bit of detail with that when they initially take Cal up to the Phantom ship and Lois also goes, has to wear the oxygen rebreather thing because the atmosphere on Krypton and the atmosphere on Earth are very different and they're not compatible.
And I think the progress of showing the struggles that any Kryptonian would have coming to Earth and experiencing that, such as Zod has throughout the entire last third of the film, up to the point to where he makes Cal aware that I was trained to know how to hone my senses and, you know, I can do the same things you can, so let's duke it out and, you know, in full godlike fashion, you know. I thought that I liked that. I liked the fact of how they were able to continue the progress of the story and show the evolution of the character without having to need to put it into a three-part trilogy or, you know, have to create a sequel to show, oh, well, by the end of this film, Zod's kind of getting it, but he's not fully there yet.
Right.
So in part two, Zod's going to become fully like Superman, and they're going to duke it out and lay waste to half the world. You know?
And here's what I think. I, like I said, I enjoyed the film when it came out. I thought that they did a unique and interesting take on Superman. A lot of people kind of dog on it for being too moody or this is emo Superman and whatever. I don't know. I think there's a lot of sunshine. He's laughing and jovial while he's learning how to fly. I mean, he's like scaring herds of animal randomly on the plains as he's doing his whole training montage. I mean, there are moments of joy and of lightness. And I thought that, like I said before, Zod is a fully realized villain. He's fairly one-dimensional, but intentionally so. I'd say the biggest issue that I have with this movie that I've had ever since seeing it the first time in the theater is the portrayal of the United States military. Yeah. And the reason I say that is because you have them there to essentially as a counterpoint to, okay, this one dude can do all this stuff, and then here's the military with all of their guns and soldiers and helicopters and whatnot, can't do a thing about it. And so that part's, you know, okay, fine. Sense of scale. That's fine. But really the way that they're used in the story most of the time is almost like a comedic subplot. You have a series of things that happen over the course of the movie that it doesn't make fun of the military by any means.
But they don't show them as any kind of powerhouse.
What the military is doing, what the characters are saying, the way that they're taken aback by a certain, you know, moment with this guy. Oh, he just broke the handcuffs. Oh, okay. It's like the military, rather than being there as an echo of the hope that is the symbol on his chest, or a companion in this fight to do what's right, we're working together. More often than not in the movie, they're kind of the comic relief. Kind of like Lombard, which is who you were talking about, the reporter. He's used as comic relief and a foil for Lois, and I think that in many respects, in terms of story structure, the American military is several times used as a counterpoint and a foil for Clark, or for Kal-El, in his full, you know, regalia as Superman. Yeah. And they also end up becoming, maybe unintentionally, they become comic relief in many regards. And they completely destroy Smallville. Who destroys Smallville?
That is true. I mean, they're shooting bullets like crazy. But I you know what? I'm a huge, huge fan of Chris Maloney. And just from his episodes on SVU and him doing the current WGN series called Underground, and I'm just the man can do no harm in my eyes, and so in my mind I actually liked his role. But I do agree with you as far as the military's role overall in the film. They do seem to kind of play as that comedic opposite to the powers of Kal-El and what he is able to do, as opposed to them, because they seem pretty much expendable throughout the entire film. No life is valued at all amongst the military when it comes to fighting Zod's men and women.
Sure, yeah. I mean, they unleash missiles and gunfire in the streets of small-town America to try to hurt these basically unhurtable alien creatures. And they're not trying, it didn't strike me as we're trying to drive them out and get the battle away from this small town.
No.
It's, we're trying to kill them here.
Yeah.
With all these people huddled behind their, you know, brick and mortar, barely even
glass
still standing,
window and,
you know, buildings.
Yeah.
And number one, it's completely irresponsible. Number two, I don't know that the actual military would behave in that way if there were super powerful alien creatures fighting it out,
yeah,
in one small town with buildings that are mostly older than, you know, the 1960s or whatever. You know, I don't know that they wouldn't, but I don't know that they would. And that was my biggest critique of the film, beyond destroying Metropolis and a large part of the Indian Ocean and all that.
Yeah.
That all goes with the operatic flavor of the way that they're telling this particular superhero story. I just thought that the American military kind of got short shrift.
And we also got a small little taste of a couple little Easter eggs here and there, like with Carol Ferris and so forth. But overall, you know what? I thought the film was pretty good. I thought it was, compared to with what we've been experiencing with Batman versus Superman, I thought the film was actually a decent movie. And I thought it was a great installment in the whole DC universe. But it got me thinking about a couple of questions. And, you know, it got us wondering and asking each other, what would you do if you could change something? Would you rather? And
why did you do it? Why did you do that thing to me?
Why would you do that?
Why did you do it? Why did you do that thing to me?
Why did you do that? Why did you do that, Terry?
The only one who knows the truth. Man, that's him, me, and you.
Would you rather? That is the name of our segment for today, if you didn't gather that from our lovely clip.
Man,
that we
that
have
was,
created.
That was a good groove going on in there.
No joke. We honestly just found that song like not even 10, 15 minutes ago, and we're like, we need to put that in the film.
We need to get that in
the film. You know, we're actually going to start, you know, producing and all that. We need
we're
to get that in the podcast.
For our own sake.
But the segment is called Would You Rather. Chad, would you like to explain a little
bit?
Sure,
absolutely. So this movie came out in 2013, mm-hmm, and pretty much immediately there were a couple of different camps. There were people that liked it, and there were people that really, really, really didn't like it. There wasn't a whole lot of middle ground. There were a lot of naysayers, and there were a couple of reasons why people were saying nay to the film.
Because they were horses.
Because
they were horses.
Well,
nay.
Okay,
nay.
Just go ahead. Sorry. Yeah, because they were horses. And so there were two primary things we're going to focus on here. Essentially, we're going to ask that question. You know, you say, why? Why did they make that decision?
Why?
Why?
That kind
yes,
of
exactly.
Exactly.
Well done.
Thank
Was that you.
You
in the original recording?
I tried, you know.
Yeah,
I did have a voiceover career a little bit.
So you have people who are asking why, and we're going to take a couple of specific story elements, and instead of just asking why would they do that, we're going to say, okay, delete that, erase that,
mm-hmm,
pretend like that never happened. So now you get two options for what you would do instead. So would you rather option A or would you rather option B?
Mm-hmm.
And why would you prefer one option to the next?
And we'll state those here on the show and we'll discuss them back and forth. But if you have any comments or you have any thoughts on these things, or if you think you may have actually had a better question to ask, by all means, leave it in the comments on our Facebook page or let us know on our Twitter page as well. But you know what? Let's go ahead and jump into this, all right?
All right.
First question is, would you rather A, have a campy-style Superman, or B, an overconfident Superman?
All right, this one for me is very easy. And let's just kind of set the stage. Mentioned it a few minutes ago, but people had issues with the way that Superman was portrayed in this movie. It's emo Superman. He's moody. He's not really having too much fun.
He's a red and blue Batman.
Yeah, he was a little brooding. He was aloof
Superman.
And mysterious. He didn't really engage with society as often as you'd expect him to. So we're saying, okay, delete that. Delete
mm-hmm.
that character aspect. Okay, campy or overconfident? For me, easy. The answer is overconfident. The reason, not because it's more dramatic, but because campy's already been done. And
That's
as
true.
I said before, I don't think that there's really a lot of point in making movies, Transformers, when it's already been done that
mm-hmm.
way. If you're not going to add something new and different, then let the original stand the way that it was.
Yeah.
People love going back and watching the Christopher Reeve Superman films,
mm-hmm.
even though they are campy as all get out. I mean, they're good. I've seen them. I like them. They're good. They're good films. They're solid films. But they're not particularly meaty. Yeah. there's not a lot of story to them, and there is a lot of camp. Kind of a slightly more mature version of that 1966 Batman TV show.
Yeah.
You know, minus the pow, zowie, zam, you know.
Bazinga.
Whatever, little icon. So for me, I would rather an overconfident Superman because it's something that we haven't seen. Unless, you know, like an episode or two of Smallville, he had some odd-colored kryptonite that made him kryptonite. That way.
Yeah.
But those were, you know, a couple of episodes here and there over the course of however many there are in 10 seasons of television. Mm. So I would say overconfident. If I couldn't have Moody, by golly, I'm going to take an overconfident
You know
suits.
What? I don't think I would buy that. I would actually – I may actually – side for the campy style Superman just for the fact that yes, we've had campy, and so I think okay, let me redefine my answer a little bit. A slightly more campy.
This is where Eddie makes a third path.
This is where, you know, I have to start splitting hairs here and
would
start.
You rather A or B? Actually,
let's do
like A-ish B.
A point one subset three of the. I would do a form of a somewhat campy style Superman, because if you're looking at the DC as a whole, other than Batman, the rest of the entire series, the rest of the other characters, they are very comical. They're comics. Right off the bat. I mean, they're illustrated.
Well, they're not like the Joker,
drawings.
Like.
No, but you do have a sense of, you know, a lot of the early Superman comics were, you know, moving a car out of the way or getting a cat out of a tree. You know, that style of rescuing and that sense of heroship, as opposed to, well, I'm over here, you know, knocking down this alien threat who's wanting to kill the entire world. I think a campier Superman with the rest of the subplots and everything that would go along with it, I think I would actually side for that. Because if you think about an overconfident Superman, then what do you have? You have, like, Hercules. You have, like, somebody who's so enamored with himself as far as what he can do and what he can't do that it usually, you know, goes with, well, the pride goes, you know, and then soon they're going to fall, you know, kind of deal.
Sure. Well, obviously, the story that you're telling with an overconfident person is you got to bring him down a notch.
Yeah.
Right. The story that you're telling with, you know, broody Superman is you got to bring him up a notch.
Broody.
And the story that you're telling with the campy Superman is, just stay the same.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I could do with a clown nosed Superman. Yeah. But we have one more question. You know.
All right. Go for it.
So, would you rather have killed Zod sooner or not killed him at all? So that is actually one of the bigger questions that a lot of people have had in regards to Man of Steel, especially with a lot of their thoughts and suggestions when it comes to that end scene.
So much time spent on the interwebs.
Tons of time, you know, complaints about how long the scene was, about how the ending finished out. So here's the question that we have for you. Would you rather A, have killed Zod sooner, or B, not killed him at all?
My answer, because I tend, don't make fun of me for this, but I tend to be a pacifist in life, I would say not killed him at all. I would have wanted to found a different solution, and I don't know what that solution would have been, but I think that it would have been far more compelling to see Superman behave in a way that mainstream humanity wouldn't think of.
Hmm.
Because he can do things that they can't. And Zod put him in an untenable position. You know, he's turning his head toward the family and gonna, you know, totally whatever, incinerate them or whatever the I-beams actually do. But,
yeah.
You know, so he put him in a terrible position and forced Superman's hand, but I think it would have been more inspiring to me if he had found a different way.
So you're saying that to not have killed him at all? To not have killed him at all.
Find something else to do with him. In the comics, he goes into the negative zone numerous times. You know, he re-imprisons Zod and a whole host of others that have, you know, that break out from time to time from this other dimension. And Superman puts them back in there.
I don't know. In my mentality, I would have considered if you would have killed Zod sooner in the film, that would create a more driving story for his cohorts and the people that were still there, because obviously everybody dies around the same time with the rest of his league and the rest of the people. I think the idea of killing Zod sooner in the film and giving an opportunity and I say opportunity because that's ultimately what it could have grown into, for the rest of his group of people to carry on that legacy of Zod and maybe have it built for like a second film, the sequel.
So you're essentially saying...
I'm saying that he
should... Kill Zod before Zod starts remaking the world.
Kill Zod...
Because they all get sucked into the black hole
right?
When...
And this is... I mean, previous to that. I mean, even if that whole storyline would have continued for a second film, to actually bring the world engine, to actually bring these things, to make Zod a imminent threat right there and then, causing Superman to have to go and take him out.
So then... When would you have killed him? Would you have had Superman kill him?
I would have had him killed in the battle at Smallville. I would have allowed that to have been the turning point, not only for his cohort to go ahead and realize that they need to take up the mantle, but also an opportunity for the military to see that this man, as Chris Maloney says in his role, this man is not our enemy. You know, he that would have given more gravitas to me to that whole scene for Clark Kent, Kal-El, Superman, however you want to call him, for him to kind of solidify his role as a protector of America.
Protect by killing.
Protect by beheading.
You know, it's interesting because you got to think, I like to think about the whole tapestry of the story. And mm-hmm. I think that... the decision to kill Zod and the reaction it causes in Clark, Cal, Superman, is one of the most compelling things about the film mm-hmm. As it stands. And I wasn't one of those that was saying, oh, how dare they have him kill the guy? Because it's not just a, I don't know, a backhand, oops, I killed him. I'm yeah. just so powerful. Yeah. I mean, It's a moment of agony, and it's a turning yeah. point for him. So I think that it had meaning. I think if they killed him earlier, before he had necessarily given, let's say, just cause by destroying a city, then it would have called into question why Clark had been following his parents' advice at all through the whole rest of the intervening parts of the movie, because he has restrained himself throughout his developing years because of what they instilled in him, which was the world isn't ready for everything that you can do. Someday they might be, but you know, you kind of got to put a lid on it. And I think it's a large portion of what motivates him to maybe not allow the battle to go on for so long, but to not take a definitive step to stop Zod earlier mm-hmm. Is because he is concerned about how he's going to be perceived by the masses.
Yeah. Well, you know, those are our thoughts. Let us know what you think in the comments of our Facebook page. Again, facebook.com/filmlosophers. Or on our Twitter page, let us know what you think at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Before we go, we want to go ahead and leave you with a couple movie bites that we have. Star Wars The Force Awakens comes out in stores on Blu-ray and DVD April 5th. I know I'm excited about it. I know you are.
It actually releases digitally a few days earlier, this Friday, April 1st. And yeah. then it comes out Tuesday, April 5th.
Yep. Another one I know Chad is excited for, Captain America Civil War, releases in theaters May 6th.
I don't think excited is a big enough word.
Yeah, we got to start creating words now. We're gonna start doing like our philosopher dictionary.
I mean, you talk about people who like to listen to themselves talk and how, you know, their brain can be an echo chamber. Yeah. My brain is a massive hype machine echo chamber about Captain America Civil War.
And it looks good. So you know what? With the way Batman vs. Superman came out this Friday and how it's following suit, let's hope that Captain America Civil War... Well, I know Captain America Civil War is going to have just as big, if not a bigger weekend coming up. One last thing, the Iron Giant Ultimate Collector's Edition. If you liked any great cartoon movie that came out during the mid-90s, the Iron Giant was definitely one of them. The Ultimate Collector's Edition is coming out to Blu-ray on September 6th. I am tongue-tied today.
September 6th. So you got a while.
6th. So you have a while.
Get that pre-order in on Amazon.
Exactly. That pre-order is going to go up, and it's going to go quick. For this episode of The Filmlosophers, I am Eddie.
I'm Chad.
And you know what? We are so glad that you could join us. By all means, again, check out the rest of our episodes on Audio Boom, Libsyn, iTunes, and Player FM. And of course, from all of us here at The Filmlosophers, we want to let you know, thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening.
And class dismissed.
Peace out.